Hi, I'm Eva.
And I'm Emma.
Welcome back to the Blue Side Podcast, the podcast for the Science Communication Society at the University of Cambridge.
Yeah, as you can hear, we have a new voice on the podcast today. Eva's joined our team of hosts and we'll be back regularly on the show. Eva, actually, do you want to introduce yourself quickly?
Yes, so I'm a PhD student in the Department of Zoology. I work on brain development in fruit flies, so I'm trying to understand how do you make a brain when you're an embryo?
I should say as well, because I don't think I've actually introduced myself before on this, I'm also a PhD student. I study molecular biology here, and my work focuses on innate immunity against Salmonella. And Sean, who isn't here today, is currently doing a Master's in Earth Sciences. So on the show today, you will hear my interview with Emily Fisk, who is a science communicator at the Cambridge Science Centre. But before, Eva talks to Berta Verd from the Department of Genetics.
Yes, so Berta Verd is a postdoc in the Steventon Lab in the Department of Genetics, and she studies axis elongation in zebrafish embryos, which is how the embryo goes from a round ball of cells to a longer structure with a head, middle and tail. And she's really interesting because she uses mathematical models to interpret the expression of different genes, which means she inputs data about zebrafish embryos into a computer program to try and figure out the rules of how the tail bud, the pre-tail of the embryo, elongates. So I'm here with Berta Verd. Berta, thank you for coming on the Blue Side podcast. So you're a postdoc at the Department of Genetics.
Yes, I've been in the Department of Genetics for almost a year and I'm in the lab of Ben Steventon there.
Okay, and what does the Steventon lab focus on?
So in the Steventon lab we use a variety of approaches to understand how zebrafish embryos develop their axes. So they start off developing a head and then they have to undergo a lot of changes and make a lot of decisions to actually elongate their axis to become full. And we look at this from a molecular and a genetic point of view, but we also do mathematical models, and that's one of the main focuses of my research.
And because you moved from totally sort of a maths background, right, into wet lab work now, and so do you do a combination of those? And also, what was that transition like?
So, yeah, it's not easy, it's still ongoing. So my background is in pure maths. I did a very traditional mathematics degree back in Spain, in Barcelona. And then I did my PhD already in developmental biology, looking at mathematical models of gene regulatory networks in the fruit fly. And I've always thought that it was very important for me, for the kind of work that I want to do, to be in a biology department, to be very close to the biology and the biologists. And that became important during my PhD, and I was exposed to a lot of biology. I was in a biology department. But then I realized that, you slowly realize that that is not enough, because for the kind of work that I want to do, I want it to be very much data-driven. I think that idealized models are very useful, but it's not the kind of work that I want to do. And for that, it's not always easy to get a biologist to get the data that you want to work with. So it became more of a necessity or a sort of a vision. And Ben Steventon, my boss, was he's been fantastic and very brave to take me on and to teach me how to do the wet lab myself.
And so what's your question? How do you apply the mathematical modelling to the elongating of the zebrafish?
So in the tail bud that is consists of a bunch of undifferentiated cells, there are also a bunch of genes that are very important to help and to determine what those progenitor cells are going to then become. So what I would like to do is measure gene expression in the tail bud, in the different regions of the tail bud, so in space and over time, and then build mathematical models of those gene networks that will help us understand how these cells then become, make these decisions of become, for example, part of the muscles and the skeleton or part of the neural tube.
Okay. And so did you work on zebrafish
during your PhD? So I was working in fruit fly segmentation in Drosophila, but I wasn't doing any experiments myself. Yeah. I was sitting in the lab and I was working, building models of the data. And the question at its core is similar and overlapping, no? Mm. It goes back to this idea of how do genes interact with each other to determine cell fate. Mm-hmm. So the question is always very similar, which means that a lot of the skills that I build, I can really ploy and use again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I did a rotation working with zebrafish during my master's year, where I worked in a few different labs. And I found the fish tank room just really amazing, number one, because I think a lot of the time, before I started my graduate program, I just always imagined that zebrafish were sort of big fish. I don't know why. I never saw a picture. I just thought of them as big. And I always thought that Xenopus, the frog that people study, I always imagined them to be sort of small, cute frogs. So I was super surprised when I walked into these labs and I saw that, well, Xenopus are actually ginormous and sort of hang in kind of an evil way in their tanks. And then zebrafish are these really tiny little fish. But they're very much sort of, I feel like zebrafish are sort of an up-and-coming model organism at the moment. Is that something you feel in the field?
I think that they have a lot of advantages, so we can do a lot with them, and they're also quite fast in becoming mature. And for me in particular, what is great is that the embryos are not super tiny.
Yeah.
You can see them, you can handle them, you can do sort of freehand embryology with them if you want. And that is a huge advantage, a huge advantage, to be able to visualize what you're working with. And I mean, they're still tricky, but they're not like other eggs, for example, Xenopus eggs. Yeah. You can't see anything inside, and they're very challenging in that respect, I think.
Mm. In terms of wet lab work, if you're trying to understand the different gene expression of the tailbud, right? So do you have to dissect the tailbud in order to run this experiment? So what's your day-to-day in the lab
practice? Well, I've only just recently started doing daily wet lab. And for now, what I'm doing is trying to characterize spatiotemporal patterns of gene expression in the tailbud, but at a fine temporal resolution, because I want my models to be dynamic, to be able to tell us how the concentrations and the spatial distribution of these genes change over time, which means that you can't get away with an early, a mid, and a late time point. Mm. So I'm trying to stage my embryos very carefully and then do HCR stains to actually visualize them. And you do that on the whole embryo. It's not until the very end when you mount them that you cut the tails off and stick them under the confocal. And I can fix them after 24 hours, more or less. So I can do a morning of fixing, and I'll have the stages that I'm interested in a day later.
Mm-hmm. So apart from feeling that sometimes biologists don't produce precisely the data that you want to do your models on, is there anything that you like about working in the wet lab nowadays?
So I should specify, now that I do...
Now that I do it myself,
I realize exactly how much work goes into the data that you guys collect. Mm-hmm. It is painstaking and it is very, very difficult. It is also very difficult to standardize certain things, for example, timing, time of development. Oftentimes, for example, in our case, it's not easy to precisely count so much. Mm. You can say, this is somewhere between 21 and 17, or something like that.
And is that how you decide how old they are, by how many? And so mites are segments of the body plan.
Yes, so that's what we're doing at the moment. We have a project that a master's student might be taking on, which will be trying to build machine learning algorithm to do this automatically for us. So you know how, for example, Google and Google has this image recognition system where there's this famous meme, is it a dog or is it a muffin?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Kind of thing. So we want to do something similar with our sailboat, so that we won't need to stage them so precisely anymore.
Mm.
And after we've imaged them, we will be able to run them through the algorithm, and it will tell us what stage it is. And the vision there is also to make it readily available online,
yeah,
so that everybody can start off by staging their own embryos very carefully, but eventually have sort of an online staging system for any embryo and any part of an embryo's body that you want.
Yeah.
But for now, we are looking at morphological signatures and embryo counting somewhat, mostly.
Uh-huh. It's interesting to me because it can be so tricky in biology to make those distinctions, which are really, really important to what you're trying to say. I did some lab work in a lab in America during my undergraduate degree where I was looking at mouse gut electrophysiology. And one thing I found that was funny in some of the papers I would read is I was looking at the large intestine, and people would just say, using the large intestine, we did X, Y, and Z. But there's a humongous difference to the electrical properties of the proximal, middle, and distal parts of the large intestine. I mean, like, you know, it on the screen when you're doing, we were doing sharp electrotechnique, where you measure voltage changes in the tissue. And you could just see this humongous difference. Like, they were clearly very different. So part of my project was trying to decide, you know, what do we count as proximal, what do we count as middle, what do we count as distal. And it's kind of, in some ways, slightly boring work, you know, creating these sort of standard ways of thinking about it. But it's really, really important if you want to be able to use something in a way that's universal.
It's also encouraging because it means that although we've been looking at, in the case of developmental biology, although we've been looking at how organisms develop for centuries, really, we realize that we haven't really characterized them at all.
Mm.
Mostly, so oftentimes because we didn't have the means, and then also other times because characterizing it carefully wasn't actually going to help with the questions as they were being posed before.
Mm.
So I think that we have a lot of work in the field, which is great.
Mm-hmm. And so outside of lab work, I know that you run a podcast yourself, a Spanish language podcast. Do you want to tell us a bit?
Sure. I don't actually run it. I'm a collaborator. Teresa Rayón from the Crick Institute is the presenter and driving force behind our podcast. It's called En Fase Experimental, which basically means something like trial stages, something
mm-hmm.
like that. And in it, we interview Spanish scientists in Spain and abroad,
mm-hmm.
and we also present in a way that's accessible to the public news items that are interesting to us. And I mean, it had been running for a while before I joined. My main motivation is so that my mother will be engaged with the science that I find interesting.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So is it focused on biology or is it science of all kinds?
We try to make it broad, but
mm-hmm.
Teresa is a biologist and Ruben, the other collaborator, and I, we're both, he's a physicist working in biology and I'm
mm.
a mathematician working in biology, so there is a strong bias there towards the biological sciences, but we try to make it as broad as we can.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so have you been involved in other kinds of public engagement or science communication during your...
I don't think so. I think that this is actually my first time. Yeah, I haven't been as good as I should have. I think that there is a little bit of a duty to communicate, obviously, but better with the public. And being selfish, I think that we as scientists would be better off if the public liked more what we're doing and were more involved in what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But also I find it now very rewarding.
Yeah. What about the paper you published with an artist as well?
Yeah, so this is a collaboration with my PhD advisor, Yogi Jaeger, and Gemma Anderson, who's a, how do I explain Gemma? It's difficult. she's an artist, but she's been working in the epistemology of drawing, so building knowledge in science through drawing. Mm-hmm. And she works at the University of Exeter very closely with a group of process philosophers, mm-hmm. and headed by, I won't remember the name, yes, John Dufresne, sorry. And she's done some really interesting work trying to help you, help them think about processual things rather than static things. And of course, that was very appealing to me because my work in biology has all been about the dynamics of gene expression, the dynamics of the developmental process. So we were both at the same time working. She was a visiting scholar at the Konrad Lorenz Institute in Vienna, which is an institute for theoretical biology. And we sat down and we started talking, and there's this concept in developmental biology called, that's known as Waddington's landscape, where Waddington basically draws a landscape, and it has valleys, and you have a ball that's at the top, and the ball falls down, and that is supposed to represent, it's a metaphor for development, how you can differentiate, or how you can specialize as development proceeds, and also how that gives you a mechanism for noise reduction as development goes on. And I've been thinking about this a lot, and I've always been uncomfortable with how people call it a metaphor. And I said to Gemma, I don't think it's a metaphor, I think it's one case. And so she said to me, so what could be the other cases? And well, one of the limitations of Waddington's landscape is that because it's a landscape with valleys, you can never have oscillations. And we know that oscillations are important mechanisms in developmental biology, at least. So I said to her, well, if Waddington's landscape wasn't a landscape of valleys, and instead it was a torus, like a donut, you could have oscillations on that donut. And then we went very crazy, and we did Waddington landscapes on all sorts of topologies, like a Klein bottle, or things like that. And that's been recently accepted for publication in a journal for arts and science called Leonardo. And actually Waddington published in the first edition of this journal, which makes me very happy.
It's amazing what can come out of casual conversation.
Yes. I think that we have to be open to. I mean, science is a very creative enterprise that we all embark in, and that creativity can be in the lab, can be in models, it can be in arts and science, it can be doing a podcast, and we should give this creativity as much outlet as we can.
So you said, as a developmental biologist, you're interested in how things change over time, the dynamics of it. Anyway, so is that what drew you to developmental biology, or did it work sort of the other way around?
That's what hooked me. That's what has really, really hooked me. I like with most things, did my PhD where I did because of coincidence. I was looking for projects. I didn't know much biology, and my supervisor was an angel fallen from heaven to give me this wonderful opportunity. But it was definitely the dynamics that hooked me. And also I think that now the field is actually changing but because the times allow it. Now in development we look at how things change. Before we could only look at snapshots that were representative of certain stages. So I also find it exciting because I think that there's a lot to do there.
Well, thank you so much for spending time chatting to me.
Pleasure.
Thank
it's been
you
a
so
pleasure.
Much. Wonderful. Thanks, Berta.
Thank you.
Thanks, Berta, for taking the time to be interviewed for our podcast. Really appreciate it. So before Emma's interview, we have our research highlights segment. Emma, you have a paper to tell us about today?
Yeah, so this comes from a study by researchers at NYU, which was published by Nature Medicine Online a few days ago, actually. I don't think it's out in print yet. And the paper starts with a fairly sobering statistic, which is that over 150,000 people die of lung cancer every year in the US alone. Now, lung cancer is actually a fairly broad term, and it refers to quite a few subtypes of diseases. And two of the most prevalent ones are called lung adenocarcinoma and lung squamous cell carcinoma. They basically differ in their cellular origins. Being able to tell apart these two types of tumours is actually very important because they respond very differently to treatments, and so it involves quite distinct therapeutic regimes. And this classification is normally done by eye, by trained pathologists, basically who examined images of lung biopsies and try to identify the tumour subtype. However, this is both quite time consuming and it can actually be quite tricky to do as well, because these two types of cancer actually look very similar under a microscope. So what people have started to look into is whether machines can be trained to do this, so to undertake a reliable automated analysis of lung cancer slides and distinguish between these two subtypes of cancer. And so this is what this group in NYU did. They trained an artificial intelligence framework, which I think is originally made by Google, to tell apart these two cancer subtypes at an accuracy of 97%, and that actually compared favourably with the quote-unquote sort of success rate of three pathologists who were then asked to analyse the same images. So now that's already really exciting, but this AI tool is even more powerful than this. So before we go further, I think it's important to note that even when they fall within the same sort of classification, for example, lung adenocarcinoma, and not all cancers are the same. So different tumours might carry different mutations, and that affects cancer cell growth, that affects their shapes, but it also makes them susceptible or resistant to different kinds of treatments. And so normally a tumour's sort of mutational profile is analysed by genetic testing, but that can take a long time. And delaying cancer treatment is obviously something both doctors and patients want to avoid for obvious reasons. So what scientists show here is that by looking at differences in, for instance, cell morphology, they could train the program to predict whether tumours carried abnormal versions of several important genes that were normally associated with cancer. And they could do so with an accuracy of 73 to 86%. So scientists are now looking to improve their program's accuracy, and they also want to extend it to other types of cancers, for example, less common lung cancers. I think this study, and these people are not the only people who do this, there's actually a whole Nature Medicine issue on this topic, but it really highlights the potential of AI technologies for public health and biomedical research. So these type of AI-based tools are still at an early stage. It's a fairly new field, but it may well in the near future become routinely used to provide pathologists with either second opinion or even help accelerate diagnosis to get patients started on targeted therapies sooner, which is really exciting.
Yeah, that is really exciting, particularly because we hear about the benefits of AI and, you know, you sort of are aware of the fact that Google work on AI and mm-hmm. it's to do with the internet and it's to do these things, but it's really nice to hear examples of that kind of work that could really, really impact people's mm-hmm. health and people's lives in a very direct way.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear it used in that kind of medical settings, not necessarily something you think about, I think.
Well, thanks for finding a really interesting paper.
That's so okay.
who's your interview with?
So my interview this week is with Emily Fisk, who is a science communicator at the Cambridge Science Centre. She just finished a PhD in microbiology, I think. And part of the reason we started this podcast was to try and talk to sort of as many people from the science community as possible. And so not just scientists who work in labs, but also people involved in, for example, science public engagement. So I was quite excited to talk to Emily about this, and I definitely recommend visiting the Cambridge Science Centre, or if you have time, you can volunteer there, which I do quite regularly. You can find all the information for this on their website if you just Google Cambridge Science Centre. So I'm joined today by Emily Fisk, who works as a science communicator at the Cambridge Science Centre. Thanks for coming on the podcast. It's very great to have you here. So, I mean, we're having this discussion in the Cambridge Science Centre, so probably that's quite a good place to start. Could you give us a bit of an overview of what the Cambridge Science Centre is, what you guys do, especially as some listeners might not have come across it before?
Yeah, so the Cambridge Science Centre has been around since 2013. The first three or so years, they had a permanent centre over in Jesus Lane in town. But after that point, the kind of lease got taken over, mm-hmm. so we had to move out a bit. But that was fine for us, because a lot of what we do is actually based on outreach. So the whole kind of idea of the Cambridge Science Centre is to increase access to STEM, or science, technology, engineering and maths, and take it to the places and people who maybe don't have access or are able to get to places like Cambridge that is mm-hmm. pretty kind of wealthy in terms of science. So yeah, we reopened our permanent centre here on Clefton Road in April. So now we have our permanent kind of space here. We've got our science exhibits gallery and stuff like that. So we do science shows and workshops. We do school visits, so they'll mm-hmm. come to here or we'll go to them. We've got a STEM club that's also running. I think it starts next week, mm-hmm. which is the first for us. So that's quite exciting. But yeah, a lot of what we do is still primarily outreach. Mm-hmm. So we like to kind of try and move as much as we can across the east of England. So we've done kind of quite a lot at the moment with Peterborough, King's Lynn. I went to the Suffolk County show and spoke to some people there. So we do kind of get around doing kind of different workshops and STEM-based mm-hmm. topics.
And is it mostly sort of hands-on activity?
Yeah, always interactive as much as we can. I don't like just sitting there and listening to people lecture, so I'm not going to do it too. So yeah, mostly just science shows and kind of different hands-on exhibits as much as we can.
Yeah. And in terms of age range, you're looking at?
We do anything from kind of age 4 to 14, really.
Right.
So the centre tends to be kind of quite young kids, but when we can go into schools, it's kind of between the years 5 and 6 in primary and 7 and 8 mm-hmm. in secondary, are kind of like the core years that we tend to see a lot of people in.
Yeah.
But yeah, depending on what topics we're doing, it might be slightly different.
Yeah. So why do you think it's so important to be able to combine not only just having a main centre, but also going to places where other centres might not necessarily go sort of outside the actual
physical...
So it's
making sure there's still no barriers to this kind of thing. So getting rid of any barriers to science and that kind of area of education. So we don't want there to be an issue if you can't afford to get to a science centre. A lot of people kind of have to travel to London to find one, mm-hmm. whereas we kind of take them to their town. So I spoke to a lot of people this weekend who are like, oh yeah, I love going to London, but it's quite far and it's very expensive and I don't have the time. Whereas when we do kind of our pop-up town science road shows, we go to them for the mm-hmm. whole week. So yeah, it's nice to be able to kind of break down the barriers, both financially, if you get a background, if you had people in foster care often don't have the time or opportunity to come. So it's nice to be able to take it to everyone and make sure there's nothing kind of stopping people.
Yeah. And you do like pop-up science in banks and stuff like that?
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah. So we do banks, we do shopping centres. We've been in an Asda before.
Yeah.
Basically any kind of community room and space that we can get our hands on, we'll kind of set up.
Yes, so cool. I was wondering if we could talk a little bit also about your background mm-hmm. and sort of career path into science communication. So you've just finished your PhD.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So what was your PhD in?
It was in biochemistry and microbiology. Mm-hmm. So I was in kind of infectious diseases. I was looking at the interaction between a specific bacteria and one of your immune cells, kind of seeing if I could manipulate the interaction and kind of help the immune cell whilst also kind of inhibiting what the bacteria was doing in terms of trying to grow and defeat you. Mm-hmm. I was trying to kind of help the body almost. Average kind of standard PhD, kind of hit and miss in terms of findings mm-hmm. and results. I think we all kind of struggle for PhDs in some way or another. But yeah, I did a lot of extra stuff during my PhD, which is what landed me here.
Yeah, so that's what I was quite curious about. So at which point did you decide that you didn't necessarily want to stay in research and start to look into more sort of science communication and public engagement stuff?
I was quite awkward in that I didn't quite get on with my supervisors, mm-hmm. so that had a big impact on my enjoyment of my PhD. And I think it was within the first year to year and a half that I kind of knew I didn't want to be in academia. I still enjoyed the idea of research and being in a lab. I just knew I didn't want to be in an academic environment, mm-hmm. And that might have been just because of my experience in the kind of local environment. The university it's at was great, and I saw people in other groups that had really good experiences. It was just the experience I had kind of warped my perception of it, I think. But yeah, this I think within that first year, I was already looking at extra stuff I could do.
So what kind of stuff did you get involved with?
One of the first things I did, so there was a group of us who started around a similar time, and there was a postgraduate committee in the medical school I was in that was kind of student-led, and you kind of ran things for students in the medical school. And we kind of started going along to this together and started to kind of get involved. And the people who were in charge of it were in their third year, leaving, wanted to hand over. Me and one of my friends who were quite keen to kind of go along and help all the time were like, oh, I guess we could maybe run this in our first year. Let's give it a go. And just kind of got stuck in. Like, yeah, we probably didn't know exactly what we were doing, but you kind of learn on the job. And we became like a really kind of strong student voice. And we got more and more involved. Because we were helping people in the medical school, our names started to travel, and we started to get kind of included in different kind of discussion groups for postgraduates as a whole across the university. So we started to kind of see all these different opportunities. And my friend, for example, then started a study on the side of his PhD, looking at the value of PhDs and what people perceive the value to be, which is quite cool. So we got all these different opportunities through kind of just taking the opportunities that were around us and then seeing where it went from there. So I had another friend, she did her master's in Birmingham and she set up Pint of Science there. Which I'd never heard of at the time, and I thought, oh, this is quite a cool thing.
Maybe for listeners we should explain what Pint of Science
is. Pint of Science is kind of like a massive international festival. It's run over 3 days in May and encourages kind of researchers to go into pubs and chat to the public about what they do. So these 3 days are the same, I think there's about 20 different cities that run it in.
I think this year was...
It might even be
30. I was involved with the Cambridge one this year. And it's in lots of countries as well.
It's just grown exponentially. Yeah. But yeah, she brought it to Sheffield. And so I got involved with that. Off the back of the success of that, we had people saying, oh, it's a shame it's once a year. You should do this more often. And we thought, yeah, maybe we should. And we came across something called PubHD, which is a very similar format, but much more kind of low key. So again, it's taking researchers into the pub. There's no slides, no kind of projections or anything, just a whiteboard and a pen, and researchers given 10 minutes to say what they do. So yeah, it's really, really easy to organise, and we did that monthly for about a year. So it's all these kind of other little things that just started to grow and evolve from the opportunities that were around us. But if I was to give one piece of advice to anyone during their PhD, it's to take those opportunities. I know you're there to do your PhD, and it's so important you do that, but at the end of the day, not everyone will want to have a job in academia, and even if you do, it's quite kind of tough to get into now. So I'd always kind of keep your options open and try and get all these different kind of things, test all these different skills and get more experience in different areas, whether you can event plan or kind of do a blog, get some IT experience. Like, they're all really, really useful.
Do a podcast.
Definitely. It's really, really valuable. And it will help you if you do stay in academia or if you don't. So it's helpful to have those skills, not just kind of staying in a lab, because I know it's quite easy to kind of become insular and just put your head down and get on with your work.
It's easy to lose track of
the real world.
It's quite impressive. So you've been here since April?
Doesn't feel that long.
Enjoyed it?
Very much so, it's flown by. I can't believe it.
Is there a particular... Do you have like a favourite thing that you guys do?
I love the outreach. As well, I do love the centre, but outreach is the kind of, it's just so, it's so varied. Like, you go into all these different schools across the east of England and you never know what you're going to get. You can be in a primary school with some year fives making some kind of fancy sailing boats, or you could be in a year eight class like firing ballistics, or talking about the evolution of the eye. And there are set pieces through a lot of these workshops that are kind of like the wow moments. Like, people kind of go, oh god, that's really cool, and you know the work, you know the stages that this normally happens. It's really nice to be able to look out and see that kind of realization on the kids' faces. It's great. But outreach is really good fun.
If listeners might want to get involved with the Cambridge Science Centre, where can they find that information? And
so there are plenty of opportunities to volunteer with us. So you can volunteer in the centre, and at the moment we're kind of shifting towards kind of volunteers. We've had loads of volunteers over the holidays and they've been wonderful, so we'd like to carry on using them giving people these opportunities. So we do that primarily at the weekends at the moment, but because we've got this STEM club starting up, we might also be offering the chance for people to get involved with that. And aside from that, we also have research that we do in town. So I was in Wisbeach this weekend chatting to people about kind of their views on science, how kind of parents perceived science when they were in school, what they think about it now. And so we often get volunteers to help out with that, so kind of interviewing the public about what they think about science, which is really fun. You get to ask kids kind of what jobs they'd like to be, whether they think that these jobs might include science. So yeah, it's really interesting. Good fun. So there's loads of different things you can do and get involved in. You can just email volunteering@cambridgesciencecentre.org.
Anything coming up in the centre over the next few months or in Cambridge that
highlight? One of the things I'm kind of working on, because one of my kind of other roles in the Science Centre is kind of to do events at the moment, and I'm organising something with the Wellcome Genome Campus. So we've got European researchers night coming up at the end of the month, and we're running an event here where all the researchers are kind of coming in, doing 5-10 minute talks, having activity stations. And we've also got a booze truck and a pizza van coming, and it's going to be great. So it's basically just a big celebration of everything European. So you've got researchers who are funded by European Marie Curie Fund, and it's just going to be a big bonanza.
And so when is that?
That's Friday the 28th of September. So if you look on the Wellcome Genome Campus or search Life Lab, you'll be able to find it there. So there's a kind of adult event in the Friday night, and then a kind of family-friendly kids version on the Saturday morning as well. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. Nervous, but very much looking forward to it.
So that takes us to the end of today's episode. Thanks again to Berta Verd and Emily Fisk for your time. We really appreciate it.
We do. If you want to get in touch with us, you can send us an email at bluesidepodcast@gmail.com. And you can also find us on Twitter at bluesidepod. And you can also find the new edition of the Blue Sign magazine, which will be out at the start of this academic term, I believe. Bye-bye.
Bye.